been looking at the superiority of Jesus, and as we pointed out at the beginning of our study of Hebrews, that we're going to see that Jesus is better. And tonight what we'll be looking at is that Jesus, high priest, his office of high priest is better than Aaron. Aaron being the only high priest that was directly appointed by God. We see that the high priests from there on out were appointed through succession, but that initially God only directly appointed Aaron and his sons to be priests, but only Aaron was the high priest. And that from there on out, we don't see in scripture that God directly appointed any other man to be high priest. And that's going to be important because we're going to look at some of the qualifications to be a high priest tonight. So there's only three verses left in chapter 4, and that starts this discussion. Let's take a look at that. But before we get into it, I was left a little bit unanswered to a question that we had last week. That was about the different types of rest. And I think I was unprepared for that because in reading through Hebrews and looking at the types of rest that we were talking about here, it didn't stand out to me that there was anything unusual. And even the commentator kind of glanced over this new word that we have in Hebrews about rest. And so I'm just going to quickly go through these different words that we have for rest and show you why I was not fully prepared for that, but I'm going to give you the answer I have here now. So the Greek word for rest is that is used only one time, and that's in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 9, is the sabbatismos. And I had portrayed this as a Sabbath rest. That's just because of where this word is derived from. This word sabbatismos has that word Sabbath in it, but it really just means rest. Just like Sabbath or sabbaton means rest. If we look at some verses that show what these words look like for sabbaton, the word Sabbath, we read that in Exodus chapter 16 and verse 30. So the people rested on the seventh day. And in Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 3, for 6 days of work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, a holy convocation. You should not do any work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord. It is a rest. Okay. So, excuse me, this word sabbaton simply means rest. And again, sabbatismos simply means rest. But what we're going to look at is that you have to take the context of the word to give us the definition. Since it's only used once in the New Testament, this word in chapter 4 and verse 9 of Hebrews, it is paramount that we look at the context in which it's in order to derive what was actually meant by what was said there. The Hebrew word Shabbat, again, means rest. We can read about that in Genesis chapter 2 and verse 2, and that's the same as the Greek word sabbaton. And Genesis chapter 2 and verse 2 says, by the seventh day, God had completed his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he had done. And then finally, we see the word, the Greek word kataposis. It means rest. And there are 9 occurrences of that word in the New Testament, 8 of which are found in Hebrews, and 1 which is found in Acts chapter 7 and verse 49. And that reads, heaven is my throne, and the earth is the footstool of my feet. What kind of house will you build for me, says the Lord? Or what place is there for my rest? And then the rest of the words that this Greek kataposis uses are in Hebrews, and that's especially right around Hebrews chapter 4 and verses 9 and 10, that word rest. When we get down to the point here, that unique word, sabbatismos, has to be taken in context with what it's talking about in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 9 and 10. And what we were talking about there is a rest. And it's the type of rest that God did when he finished creating. So I apologize for any confusion that I had brought up with the idea that there were two different types of rest. But the whole point here is being that it's talking about a completion, a finality, and that this word sabbatismos, this rest that Christians can look forward to, that it being similar to the rest that God did after he finished creating, leads us to the idea that it's a final rest. That is, it is, there will be no more done after that rest. So I hope that helps clear that up a little bit. The idea that all these words are looking at that idea of rest, some of them being a temporary rest, but the ones we're talking about in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 9 and 10 are a final rest. Rest for us, similar to the rest that God did after creation. Getting into our study tonight, Hebrews chapter 4, we're going to be looking at verses 14 through 16. So these three verses act as a transition from our previous discussions into this next discussion that we're going to have here, and that is Jesus as high priest. And so because of Jesus' greatness, we start in chapter 4 and verse 14. It reads, "Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let's hold firmly to our confession. For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things, just as we are, yet without sin. Therefore, let's approach the throne of grace with confidence, so that we may receive mercy and find grace for help at the time of our need." So, because of Jesus' greatness, it's important that we hold fast to our confession. This Son of God, this Christ, is great. And what we're going to see introduced here is that he is our great high priest. He is the mediator. In verse 15, it says, "We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize." And the next chapter, chapter 5, is going to spend the first four verses showing us the qualifications of a high priest. And so we're going to look at those qualifications of the Levitical high priest. That's what the first four verses are of chapter 5. And then we're going to look at the qualifications of Jesus as our great high priest. And that's verses 5 through 10. Because of Jesus' human experience, because he understands, because he can sympathize with our weaknesses, let's approach that throne of grace with confidence. Let's break these down. We have a great high priest. Jesus was called our high priest in chapter 2, verse 17, chapter 3, verse 1, and chapter 4, verse 10. This demonstrates that in Jesus we have something better than Jewish priests, even Aaron. No Jewish priest was ever called great. And this great high priest who has passed through the heavens, what does that mean to us when we see that he has passed through the heavens? What do you get from that?
He was crucified. He was in heaven, and he is in heaven.
Okay.
And he
All
came.
right. Keep going.
Just he came, and he came from heaven. So I mean, he's eternal. And we
Okay.
have nothing.
Okay. That's great. That's a great point.
Hey,
Let's
Ted.
remember who, yeah, go ahead.
As I look at that, here's what I get from it. The Jews had this particular picture of the heaven and the earth, and they divided the heavens into seven parts. The highest of those parts was where God lives. The lowest part of the heaven is where the birds fly. And then there are these different regions of heaven, for want of a better term. So Jesus, in coming to the earth, passed through all of those heavens to get to earth, and then, having gone back to the dwelling place of God, he went back through all of those heavens. And so I see, in terms of the Jewish understanding, that he had passed through the heavens, that it's an indication that he came from God to earth and went back to heaven.
Okay. And that's a great assessment. This would also call to the Jews this Day of Atonement, the idea of when the Jewish high priest passed from the altar of burnt offering through the room of the called the holy place, beyond the veil, into the Holy of Holies. So on one of the trips into the Holy of Holies that day, he carried the blood from a sacrificial animal and sprinkled it on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. And in Israel, the sacrifice was not complete when the animal had been killed on the altar, a burnt offering. Not until the blood had been sprinkled on the mercy seat was the sacrifice considered effective. Likewise, Jesus' atonement was not complete at the cross, not until he had entered heaven as the high priest, having made atonement for sin, was his atonement complete. And we can read that in Hebrews 9:12. And that reads, "And not through the blood of goats and calves, but through his own blood, he entered the holy place once for all time, having obtained eternal redemption." So not until he passed through the heavens into the very presence of God, and there offered, as it were, his blood on the antitypical mercy seat, were men's sins forgiven. And that's the commentator's quote there. But we can see how the Jew who this letter is written to, the Hebrews, would understand this reference to passing through the heavens and to what it would mean for the high priest to pass into this Holy of Holies and to offer that sacrifice on the mercy seat. In verse 14, it says, "Therefore, since we have this great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let's hold firmly to our confession." So Jesus, the Son of God, we start with Jesus, his human name. But he's also the Son of God. He is deity. So we have that he is human and he is deity. The great high priest of Christians is not just a human being, a physical descendant of Aaron. Not so much, since he was from the tribe of Judah, but a much greater Son of God. And so as we can start to compare Jesus to Aaron, the fact that he was not physically descended from Aaron, but he was a Jew of the tribe of Judah, we're going to see why he is qualified to be a high priest, even though all of the Jewish priests and high priests had to be of the tribe of Levi. And so we're going to see why he is greater than the Aaronic or Levitical priesthood. And then it says, "Let us hold fast to our confession." And again, we go back to how Dean introduced this. This is a letter directed to Jews, directed to the Hebrews, especially to Hebrew Christians who were thinking about going back into the law of Moses and leaving Christianity behind. The writer here is again encouraging these Hebrews to hold fast to that confession, not to slip back into the Jewish religion, not to renounce Jesus, not to renounce your great high priest, but to hold fast to that confession that you made, that Jesus is the Son of God. And being the Son of God, he has the authority and the power to save us. It goes on in verse 15 to say, "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who has been tempted in all things, just as we are, yet without sin." Jesus understands us. He gets us. He personally endured the weaknesses of humans. He knows our needs, and he knows our desires. He experienced all of that. His temptations were real. The devil used every temptation he can use on a man against Jesus. Jesus' deity did not give him advantages to overcome temptations which other mortals do not have. He shared in all aspects of the things we are tempted by and has sympathy towards us because of that. But the one who has been tempted in all things just as we are, God cannot be tempted to sin. But as Jesus, as a man, he was human. And he was tempted just as we are. But what we see is, yet without sin. He did not succumb to those temptations. Otherwise, he could not be our great high priest because he would have sinned. He did all of these things. He understands everything we went through, but he did it without succumbing to those temptations. And that's what uniquely makes him our great high priest. So we are encouraged. Therefore, let's approach the throne of grace with confidence. Since Jesus is exalted and able to be sympathetic to our plight of temptation, we are urged to continue an action that should already be going on. We should be approaching that throne of grace regularly. Let's approach that throne of grace with confidence. He's our mediator. He's our great high priest. Don't give up on him. We have confidence, no fear of rejection when approaching that throne, that we will be reconciled to God through Jesus. He's on a throne of grace rather than a judgment seat. We can be assured that Jesus will stand next to us. There's no reason for us to worry about that. We have named the name of Jesus. If we are willing to stand by that name, if we are willing to continue to worship God and serve Jesus, serve the Christ, the Messiah, there is no reason for us to fear rejection, but we can have confidence when we approach that throne of grace.
Ted,
so that we may, yeah, go ahead.
Lee brought to my attention that chapter 2, verse 8, "For in him he himself hath suffered being tempted, he is able to succor them that are tempted."
Right. 18. Exactly. We have a great high priest who experienced all of the temptations that we experience. And because he experienced that, he can have compassion on us. He can sympathize with us. He knows what it's like. And so he can be merciful to us because he knows what we have gone through and are going through and continue to go through. Verse 16 continues on. It says, "Therefore let's approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace for help at the time of our need." The attitude we find when we approach Jesus on his throne is grace. That is forgiveness that we do not deserve. But that's the attitude that we can find from Jesus when we approach his throne. He is willing to forgive. He wants to be gracious toward us. He wants to have mercy on us sinners because he understands the temptations we've gone through. He understands that we have failed, but that we are looking for a way out. And he being Jesus, who went through all of those temptations and knows what it's like, is uniquely qualified to be merciful to us. And he's also uniquely qualified because not only did he suffer those temptations, but he stayed sinless. He did not succumb to them. He remained sinless. So we can receive grace from that throne of grace. The help that we need desperately because of our sins, temptations, weaknesses, trials, our great high priest can help us. He is uniquely qualified to sympathize with us and to understand what we are going through. So if verse 15 gives evidence that our great high priest has perfect knowledge of the help we need, then verse 16 assures us that the help will be given as needed and in the time of need. And we need to remember that. These verses are so powerful in reminding us what we have in Jesus as a great high priest and the offerings that he gives us, the things he can do for us, and the ability he has to help us through these issues that we deal with in our life, sin and temptation, weaknesses and trials, and that he can offer help to us. And that's the transition from our previous study into what we're going to look at now, is that Jesus is better qualified than Aaron to be our high priest. So the first four verses of Hebrews chapter 5 are going to give us the qualifications of a Levitical high priest. So starting in verse 1, it reads, "For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of the people in things pertaining to God, in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sin. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself is clothed in weakness. And because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins for himself as well for the people. And no one takes the honor for himself, but receives it when he is called by God, just as Aaron also was." So let's break this down a little bit and look at what these qualifications are like. So for every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of the people. Since Aaron is mentioned in verse 4, it is pretty sure that what we're talking about here is the Levitical priesthood. We see that the example is given in verse 4 that of how Aaron was selected by God. So verses 1 through 3 are talking about the high priest that was elected by God in that Levitical priesthood. So qualification one of a high priest is that the high priest had to be one of the people whom he represented. Exodus chapter 28 verse 1 reads, "Then bring forward to yourself your brother Aaron and his sons with him and among the sons of Israel to serve as priest to me, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar, Aaron's sons." So the high priest was appointed by God to benefit men, not to benefit God. God didn't have any need of a mediator, but sinning men do. And Exodus chapter 29 spends that entire chapter talking about what Aaron needed to do in order to be qualified, in order to be acceptable to God as a high priest, what he had to go through, how he had to be clothed, what his tasks were, how he was to sanctify himself, how he was to cleanse himself, cleanse the altar, all of the things that were required for him to approach God. But the number one qualification is that the high priest had to be one of the people whom he represented. And we see that Aaron was a Levi. He was from that tribe, and he was an Israelite. So he was one of the people taken out from among them. He wasn't a foreigner. He wasn't a non-Israelite. He was of the people of Israel. And that man taken, appointed on behalf of the people in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins. So this is a reference to things necessary to sustain God's holiness and his government, which was what the Levites were responsible for. They were responsible for making sure that the people knew what they were supposed to do to serve God. And when they failed, they were responsible for helping the people obtain atonement for sins. They were the mediator between the worshipers and God. And we see two different things mentioned here in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices. Gifts were usually like grain offerings, where sacrifices would usually denote the spilling of animal blood. So, and except unless you're talking about the very, very poor who could not afford to give an animal in sacrifice, when you're talking about sacrifice, you're talking about spilling blood. Whereas gifts were those grain offerings. The priest offered to God the gifts and the sacrifices that were brought by the worshipers. And we can read of several occasions where people who were not qualified to offer sacrifices did so to their own peril. That generally led to their death. And so it was always the responsibility of the priest to do the offering for the people. The worshiper would bring their gift or their sacrifice, but they would bring it to the priest who would do the offering. So that was the job of the priest. That was their function. In verse 2, he says, he can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself is also clothed in weakness. Qualification number 2, then, for a high priest is compassion. That is that the high priest understands that middle ground. The high priest could not be indifferent to sin, but he could also not be too harsh so as to turn, a worshiper away by being too harsh upon them when they had committed sin. The priest could be gentle since he himself shares in the same weaknesses. Aware of his own physical and moral frailties, he is qualified to minister to these people. It was upon the high priest to decide in any given case whether or not a sacrifice could be legally offered for the sin committed. If it was sin through ignorance or error, then the sacrifice might be offered and the sin might be forgiven. If the sin was committed in insolence or open rebellion against God or his government, then no sacrifice could be offered and the sin was not forgiven. The presumptuous sinner was to be put to death at the mouth of two or three witnesses. And we can read about that again in Leviticus and Exodus. This idea being that forgiveness of sins is not just something that's going to happen. We need to remember that forgiveness of sins of error or sins of ignorance were things that the priest would have to make a judgment about. But the priest needed to be compassionate and needed to make sure that what he was doing, that he wasn't indifferent towards the sins of the people, but that he was not being too harsh, that he wasn't being, that his judgment wasn't too overt upon those who were coming looking for forgiveness of sins. So that second qualification is important because the high priest needs to be able to understand what the people are going through, what the worshipers are dealing with, what kind of temptations and trials they're going through.
Ted,
Yeah.
make me think of of premeditation, like with murder, that if they could prove that, then they would take somebody out and stone them, from what you just said. But if you have somebody like Bernie Madoff, who ripped all of those people off with premeditation, the same result would have been back during that time period. They would have taken him out and stoned him at the testimony of two or three.
Two or three witnesses. Yeah. I mean, that was that Mosaic law. Now, what we're going to see is things are changed with the great high priest. Now, that doesn't mean that Jesus is going to forgive sins for anything, but what that does mean is, because he understands what we are going through, because he understands the things that we have gone through. And as far as your example goes, if you want me to say whether or not Bernie Madoff would have been stoned, I can't tell you that. I don't know. I am not living under the Mosaic law, and I don't know how the priest would have dealt with that. But I'm sure there were people who were, tipping the scales, shall we say, and cheating. That was happening on a regular basis, I'm sure. And whether or not they were judged as harshly as they should have been, I can't say. I do not know. I know that what comes to mind is the old phrase, let's see how it goes. Let he who is out without sin cast the first stone, or be careful throwing stone in glass houses, kind of thing. It puts a lot of prayer, supplication. I can imagine that it was a heavy burden for the high priest dealing with many of the sins of the people. But again, that's where compassion comes into play, because the high priests too, as we saw, made error. Aaron's sons were killed because they used the wrong fire. God killed them himself. And so the priests also were sinners. They made choices that were against God's will. And so that's why they always, on the Day of Atonement, had to offer sacrifices for their own sins first before they could offer sacrifices for the people, because they were sinners as well.
Say, Ted?
Yeah, Lenny.
The sacrifices that the high priest made for sins didn't forgive sins. It just puts them out. The only thing that it did was purify those people.
Yeah. And as we understand, the sacrifices push that sin forward. Because sins weren't forgiven until Jesus died on the cross. What Hebrews 5 and verse 3 tells us, as it reads, and because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins for himself as well as for the people. The offering the sacrifice for sins doesn't forgive the sin, but it made those people right with God at that time. God, knowing that the ultimate sacrifice for sin was coming, but by following these instructions, the people were able to cleanse themselves of sin to the point that they could be cleansed by the grace of God. So chapter 5, verse 3 reads, and because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins for himself as well as the people. The Day of Atonement was arranged by God to require the high priest to make that atonement for his own sins before he could make atonement for the sins of the people. You can read about that in Leviticus chapter 9 and verse 7. That reads, Moses said to Aaron, come near to the altar and offer your sin offering and your burnt offering. so that you may make atonement for yourself and for the people. Then make the offering for the people so that you may make atonement for them, just as the Lord has commanded. The idea being that these Aaronic or Levitical high priests were sinners. They committed sin just like every other man. And so they had to offer that sacrifice for atonement for their sin before they could offer for themselves, before they could offer a sacrifice for the people. And again, as Lenny pointed out, this wasn't to forgive sins. This was for atonement for sin. Forgiveness of sins is through the blood of Christ. And Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 4 reads, "And no one takes the honor for himself, but receives it when he is called by God, just as Aaron also was." So this gives us qualification number 3, divine appointment to the office. It would be presumptuous for any sinner to assume the office of his own initiative. The appointment must wholly depend on God's instruction. And that's what we read in Exodus chapter 28, verses 1 through 3. Where God specifically appoints Aaron. That reads, "Then bring forward to yourself your brother Aaron and his sons with him from among the sons of Israel to serve as priests to me, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, Eleazar, Ithamar, Aaron's sons, and you shall make holy garments for Aaron, your brother, for glory and for beauty. You shall speak to all the skillful people whom I have endowed with the skill of wisdom, that they may make Aaron's garments to consecrate him, that he may serve as priest to me." So God clearly appointed Aaron in Scripture. We can read more about that in Leviticus chapters 8 and 9. The other high priests besides Aaron were named through succession. And that's spelled out for us in Numbers chapter 16, verse 40, and then chapter 18, verses 1 through 7, where we are told how the other high priests who would follow Aaron would be appointed. Numbers chapter 16 and verse 40 tells us, as a reminder to the sons of Israel, so that no layman, anyone who was not of the descendants of Aaron, would approach to burn incense before the Lord, then he would not become like Korah and his group, just as the Lord had spoken to him through Moses. So there were those who were trying to take on the garment of priest. And were paying dearly for that with their lives, because they were doing something that they were being presumptuous. They were taking on that role under their own initiative, not appointed by God. And so we see that this third qualification for a high priest, it requires divine appointment to the office. So Hebrews chapter 5, verses 5 through 10 shows us how Jesus is superior to Aaron. He is better qualified to be our high priest than Aaron was.
Hey, Ted?
Yeah, go ahead, Dean.
Before we pass on from this, you have to understand that in Roman times, the high priesthood was not what it should have been. So this is a slap at the high priests, particularly Annas and Caiaphas, who were serving as high priests when Jesus was crucified. Josephus says that the Romans deposed high priests so often that they came to think of it as an annual appointment. It's a real slap at the Jews who had so corrupted the ideal priesthood of the Old Testament that it's now something that's bought and sold. Basically, you are subservient to the Romans, and if you're doing the best job of that, you get to be high priest.
Exactly, and we see that I would find it hard to believe that any of the priests in that time could meet all of the qualifications that were part of those high priest qualifications.
Yeah, and in particular, read about Annas and Caiaphas. When you think about what was going on when Jesus is being sacrificed, the high priest is presiding over the trial, and obviously he knows that Jesus is sinless, but he presides over this trial, and then somehow he washes his hands and he goes and helps with the Passover sacrifice. That it's just inconceivable how corrupt the priesthood had become by the time of Jesus. So this is a slap. This is taking the Jews and saying, look, yes, you have priests now, but they are by no means what they should have been.
And too, it's a reminder of what they should have been.
Yeah.
He's spelling out specifically in these four verses. I mean, just four verses is enough to spell out to these Jews who should know what a high priest should look like, spelling out to them exactly what they should be like. And the number two qualification, compassion. Though the high priests in Jesus' time were anything but compassionate. They absolutely did not show that moral value in any way, shape, or form. They were more concerned about themselves and their power than they were about showing compassion to the people. So, yeah, and this was.
Yeah, I think that's why Jesus was able to go into the temple. Remember, it's the priests who've set up the money changers' tables, and it's the priests who are selling the animals so that they could make a profit off of the requirement that you have a perfect animal. Jesus upsets all of that, and what's really interesting is that he was able to do that, and the priests had no response.
Because they knew they were in the wrong.
Yeah.
They knew that they were doing something that was forbidden or not authorized by God.
And so did the people that were looking at it. They didn't stop Jesus either.
Right. Jesus was doing his Lord's work and had the wrath of God, a justified, deified wrath upon this sinful act, a slap in the face to the way God had set up the sacrificial system. And Jesus was righting the ship, shall we say, because it had gone adrift for sure. So the last six verses we're going to look at tonight are specifically looking at how Christ is superior to Aaron. So the qualifications of Jesus are given, but they're given in the reverse order. We're going to start here with the idea that he was appointed by God. He did not choose himself. So let's read through these six verses here, starting in Hebrews chapter 5 and verse 5. So too, Christ did not glorify himself in becoming a high priest, but it was he who said to him, "You are my son, today I have fathered you." Just as he also says in another passage, "You are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek." In the days of his humanity, he offered up both prayers and pleas with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death. And he was heard because of his devout behavior. Although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. And having been perfected, he became the source of eternal salvation for all those who obey him, being designated by God as high priest according to the order of Melchizedek. So qualification one is he was appointed by God. He didn't choose himself. Christ was not of the tribe of Levi, but of the tribe of Judah. So you start out by saying, well, was he even qualified to be a high priest? Nevertheless, he was not an intruder. And we're given two scriptures from Psalms that give us the reason why he was not disqualified of being a high priest. The first is Psalm chapter 2 and verse 7, where God says that he is the Son of God. The Old Testament taught that the Messiah would be a high priest. The Messiah would be of the order of Melchizedek, not Aaron. The idea being here that he is qualified to be a high priest because, one, he is of the order of the high priest Melchizedek, and two, because he was chosen by God. God directly called him. Qualification number two is his oneness with those who he represents, so he can sympathize with them. In Hebrews chapter 5 and number 7, it says, in the days of his humanity, when he was called Jesus, he offered up both prayers and pleas with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his devout behavior. And although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. So his prayers were to God, and his obedience was to God. But we see that he also suffered. He could sympathize with those around him. He was one of us. He was a human. And he dealt with all of the temptations, all of the trials that we go through. He just did it without sinning. He did it without falling. He did it without making a mistake. He also knew that God could save him from death and could let him avoid the cross, but also knew that God could raise him. Yes, Jesus was afraid. He prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane, if it be your will, take this from me. But not my will, yours be done. He was a man. He was afraid. But he brought his human will in line with his divine will. He did what was necessary. He did what he was appointed to do. And then qualification number three, compassion. He offered prayers and pleas with loud crying and tears. He learned obedience through suffering. He was perfected and is now the source of eternal salvation, conditionally for all those who obey him. These six verses spell out to us how important it is that we understand that Jesus is uniquely qualified to be our high priest, that he is qualified because he was appointed by God. He's qualified because he was one of us. And he's qualified because he understands us. He has compassion for us. He wants to help us. If this doesn't give you encouragement to know that Jesus is on your side, I don't know what will. Because he is sitting at the right hand of God on that throne of grace, ready to give help in our time of need. And he's qualified to do so. He was perfected through the things he went through as a human in his short life here. And he is uniquely qualified to be a source of salvation for us who are willing to obey him. Any questions? Any thoughts? Did I say it all? I mean, I can't have said everything that this that these passages talk about.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think Jesus as our high priest is probably one of the most comforting thoughts we can have.
I wholeheartedly agree. We have somebody who, as we can read, experienced all the temptation, went through all the trials, suffered a bitter death, crucifixion, and went into this whole thing knowing that he was going to have to face this, but did it for us. And not only did he do it for us, he did it perfectly for us. That makes him uniquely qualified to be our high priest. I wouldn't want anybody else to be a mediator between God and myself, because Jesus went through it all, but he's there for us. Well, that's all I have for tonight about Jesus as our high priest. And we're going to see Jesus as our high priest several times throughout this book. This is just the beginning of it. This is showing that he is qualified to do so. And now we're going to see what we get from that, what we can learn from Jesus as our high priest, and how we can benefit from him being in that position. We're going to see that throughout this book. The next part of this is the third warning passage. It's Hebrews chapter 5, verse 11 through chapter 6 and verse 20. It's a little bit longer reading, so we will get through that. I think I can do it in one evening. It may be that we have to divide it up into two. I'll know once I am finished with putting that together. But we'll be looking at Hebrews 5:11 through 6:20 next week on Wednesday. And so I invite you all to be here.
Hey, Ted, are you teaching that or am I?
I'm thinking of, I was going to look at my calendar here. Hold on just a second. I'm working a closing shift, so that'll be on you.
We won't get through all of that.
See, that's why I said it'll probably be, I don't even know that I could get through all of it. And so that's our next section that we'll be looking at. And it, like I said, when we started into this section, it'll probably take us a couple weeks to get through it. So I'll let you start it, and then I'll back clean up.
Okay. Thanks.
Were there any other comments or questions this evening?
I had a question. What do you mean by third warning?
We had looked previously. Let me see if I have my other. I'm going to pull up the other warnings we had looked at.
I was trying to find in my notes any warnings, but I didn't.
Yeah.
So when
I presented the. Oh, go ahead, Ted.
The first warning passage was chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. That's an exhortation to pay closer attention to what we had heard, the penalty for disobedience in the Old Testament, the okay. obligation to pay attention to the gospel. That was the first warning. And then the second warning passage, I'm getting to it here. Give me just a second here. Was chapter 3, verse 7. These were warnings, starting with that, and it goes through chapter 4 and verse 13. Warnings and exhortations with respect to our pilgrimage is what that turns out to be. The idea that we looked at, this was the passage we looked at when they provoked me in the trials in the wilderness, where your fathers were testing me. don't harden your hearts. These warnings about not entering into God's rest that he had given to all of the Israelites that were in the wilderness, and he swore to them that they would not enter into his rest because they were so disobedient to him, and that we need to do our very best not to be like those people and not to be turned away by God and not enter into his rest because of our disobedience. And so this third warning passage is, again, warnings about, let me get back over to it. Not being dull of hearing, and an exhortation to go forward into spiritual maturity. The idea being that we need to be continually learning, as we read in Peter, we need to be continually working on ourselves spiritually and growing in our spiritual character and nature, continuing to come closer to God in our walk with God and living our lives accordingly, not being Christians in just in name, but Christians in the way we live our lives and how we treat each other and how we treat those who don't know God, always looking to better our, not only ourselves, but always looking to put others in front of ourselves. So this is the third warning passage about what happens when we don't listen to God.
Okay, thank you.
Absolutely. Any other questions or thoughts?
Yeah, when I presented the second warning, I presented it not so much as a warning, but as an encouragement to pay closer attention.
Yeah. Yeah, and
that's probably the difference in the language.
Yeah. No issue there. It's the idea being that the writer here is helping us focus our minds on what's important and not overlooking how we deal with our relationship with God.